listening to The Koreaphile. I'm Andre Goulet. The Koreaphile is a monthly podcast exploring Korean society, culture, and politics, and highlighting critical, independent voices you won't find anywhere else. On this episode... traditional Korean homes have become victims of a recent onslaught of gentrification in Seoul's Ikseondong and Bukchon. But as these old residential neighborhoods become a haven for hipsters and young urban professionals, the unique cultural footprint of an important aspect of Seoul's history is being erased. Here to tell us more is Jihoon Suk, a PhD student in Asian languages and cultures at the University of Michigan and a keen observer of cultural heritage in the metropolis. Jihoon, welcome to the Koreaphile.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as gentrification liquidates the cultural capital of Seoul's heritage neighborhoods, I want to take a moment to sort of investigate the legacy of these neighborhoods. So tell us more about Bukchon and Ikseondong.
So the Bukchon and Ikseondong areas, basically modern, I mean, when I say modern, of course, it's like post-1876, and mostly I'm referring to the colonial era. So these areas were residential areas developed in this time period, particularly after the late 1920s all the way up to about the 1950s. And this used to be, Bukchon and Ikseondong areas used to be like, used to have been occupied with this big stately homes of the Joseon Dynasty, mostly with higher court officials. But as time went on, these houses disappeared, and what eventually filled up the space was all these newly developed areas. But instead of building modern, like when I say modern is like, of course, Western houses in this area, they decided to build up more cheaper to produce Hanok, but although, of course, much more modernized than like in, you know, quote unquote, traditional houses. So a lot of these houses do show this very peculiar mix of, you know, so-called traditional building techniques, but also some modern appliances as well. So it's quite fascinating in that regard. And of course, as the city grew, the modern city grew in the first half of the 20th century, and of course later on, these areas tend to had put a lot of important and interesting people living in the area. It's also one of the few areas in the old city, like areas that still has this sort of like a more or less traditional looking views of the area, like of the residential areas.
And so the neighborhood was left largely, these neighborhoods were left largely intact during the war?
Yes, for some reason, because a lot of time, and most of the actual battle was actually in the city center, which is actually slightly far away. And rarely did they actually, I mean, I don't really think any parts of Bukchon, especially places like Kahwedong or Jaedong or all these smaller neighborhoods, I don't think they were actually affected by the war at the time.
Well, and so now these neighborhoods have been turned into kind of like destination points for younger people, let's call them in Seoul. Hipsters is sort of a derogatory term that some people like to use to describe the kind of clientele who are visiting now, the sort of more modern cafes and bars or things like that in Ikseondong and Bukchon. But the remodeling process that a lot of these businesses have went through for converting these hanok, it's pretty invasive, right? So, like, I'm sure you've been to these converted heritage buildings. What can you tell listeners about what that remodelization process looks like?
So, of course, I can go on lengths for hours about this. The biggest problem about these remodeling processes is that even though they generally have good intentions to, like, in a way to preserve them for their own purposes, the big problem here is that not many people, in fact, hardly anyone who is actually going through all this process doesn't really know. I mean, they just don't really know much about the hanoks themselves. They just don't know how these things are put together. And because of that, they just, instead of having all these, beams and frames and, you know, columns or like all these structurally important, structurally important parts of the building, integrated parts of the building, they cut off a lot of these sections and replace them with modern H-beams and or glass windows and glass walls or like things. But of course, these things just doesn't really hold up well with these structures.
Right. Well, and one of the most popular hipster cafes in Bukchon actually played a crucial role in Korea's modern political history, which is kind of why it seems even more tragic that this building has been kind of gutted and turned into a modern building. So tell us more about this building. Who was Han Hak-soo?
So Han Hak-soo was a wealthy landlord, quite a famous person who also owned who was most famous for being the grandson of Han Ju-seol, who was one of the few cabinet members who opposed the signing of the so-called Usa Treaty of 1905. Many people who would listen to this podcast would know that that treaty, of course, was effectively stripped off the diplomatic rights of Korean government to Japan. Han Hak-soo, besides being the grandson of this important figure, historical figure, he also was a wealthy landlord, and he was also an educator, and he had a fairly fascinating life. But also, as we will talk about later, some of these particularly his house played a quite an important role.
And you've talked about the real historical significance of the house, and it can be traced to that sort of post-independence era that you're beginning to describe here. So it was a gathering place for well-known independence activists and leaders living in Bukchon, sort of maybe some of the elites of that time. Tell us more about that.
So as I said earlier, after the Bukchon area was developed, these were fairly middle to upper class homes. I mean, they were not necessarily for low class individuals or anything. These are definitely middle class residential area. And because of that, a lot of prominent figures, politicians, national leaders, independent activists, or all these people, all these learned people, wealthy people, and politically active people were gathering gathered together in this area, living in this area since the late since the very beginning of this creation of Bukchon area in the 1920s. And so what happened, of course, was that right after the liberation took place in August 1945, Han Hak-soo basically opened up his house because it was quite a convenient place. It was right next to a big road, and it was right next to a big school, which is now the Hyundai headquarters is occupying that site. But there was a big school there, which was frequented as a big public gathering place. And as many of these leaders, as I said, lived around this town, this particular blocks. I mean, they literally lived in a couple of blocks within. So because of that, Han Hak-soo generously offered his house to be these meeting spots for a number of these leaders, political leaders, and to create their a lot of these political parties, including the Korea Minjudang, the Korea Democratic Party, which is basically the first party in Korea that had the name Democratic within the actual name of the party. Besides that, there were many other political gatherings, at least two more political meetings to create a political parties, respectively. And
so hearing you sort of describe this interesting time in this building's history makes it easy to understand why preservationists and historians in Korea are experiencing a sort of mounting sense of dread and alarm about the changes happening to this hanok, among a lot of others in the neighborhood. So I imagine listeners of this show are probably pretty aware about the really urgent need for heritage conservation in Korea, because at times it's maybe been neglected in the country. So Seoul's city government actually appears to be interested in engaging with the issue. In fact, this summer's announcement that the city would create a list of traditional houses that could receive architectural heritage designation for their historical value by June of next year seems promising. It seems like a good step forward. But is this sort of pledge from Seoul city government coming too late to affect much change, do you think?
Yes, I think I'm afraid to say that this is a little bit too late to do this kind of actions, actually. And for one thing, of course, the house we just talked about, of course, it's not only is quite historically significant, it also is quite significant in its own architectural legacy, because it's one of the very few surviving bigger houses that was located in this area. And sadly, as I said, it was completely gutted out, and much of the original integrity and then much of the interior was completely destroyed. Not only that, this is not the first time that Seoul city government had this sort of like this policy, this like planned this kind of like actions to like to preserve some of these traditional houses. This is not the first time. They started doing, the first time they actually did this was in 1977, and they did designated a number of houses, but half of these houses are in ruins now. And there were like many other instances, like more smaller scale ones that that the city tried to keep up some of the some kind of like a list of like more or less important houses and all that. But the problem doesn't really go up. It goes with the actual policy and how ineffective they are. I think the bigger problem here is that they have like the whole notion of how they actually understand Hanoks to be. They have this very fixed notion about what Hanok should look like. And but as I said, much of these houses in Pukchons and all these different places in different parts of Seoul, they are mostly late 19th and early 20th century creations, and they do effectively have some modern appliances applied to these things as like when they were first built. But most Seoul city officials wouldn't actually understand that part. Instead, they will just have this very fixed image, very generic image of a Hanok, how a Hanok should look like. And even if they actually, you know, do something about these houses and try to restore them, it's actually doing more harm than good.
Well, so as like besides the Han Haksu home, there's another one that you spoke about recently in an interview you gave to the Korea Times. You talk about another unusually large Hanok at Ikseondong 155. Right now, it's both a restaurant and the site of Chosun Sungak Yonguhae, a vocal music group. You describe this building as the sort of origin point for pansori, the traditional song performance. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And this organization was first organized in 1930. It was a different name back then, but effectively what it was is basically it was ostensibly a guild for all these number of traditional musicians. Like they call them old-fashioned musicians. A lot of these people just figured that by the early 1930s they needed to, you know, like organize some sort of like a, you know, guild to organize themselves so that they can actually more effectively more like theatrical engagements or other other activities related to their performances. And a lot of times, most of the prominent members, there were many types of different types of traditional music that was involved within this group, but the most prominent members of this group was basically the big pansori performers who made their names since the early 1900s. And so they bought this house, they used this house as their kind of like their like headquarters. And what they mean by that was that not only they had all these performances, they also had dabbled in businesses, especially with theatrical engagements or radio broadcasts or like radio or record recordings. They also basically sort of like a conservatory in a way, because they also had many younger potential singer musicians who would just have them in this place. And these students, quote unquote, would live in this large house with all these big masters, and they would just sing and practice day and night. And and of course they became the members of this organization as well later on. And you have to realize that all these big pansori singers today are literally almost 90% of them all. They are literally just pupils of these people who were these younger members of the Joseon Seonghang Yonguhae in the 1930s. So mm-hmm. you have this whole genealogy of pansori performers all directed to this particular organization.
Well, and so I mean, this speaks to the sort of tragedy of these buildings of cultural value being maybe permanently lost. And so it sounds like you're saying that the city's engagement efforts to preserve cultural treasures is like too little, too late. So What will the city do when the hipster hanok cafe trend is over?
That I can't say anything for certain, because I honestly don't see any hope in this regard. Unfortunately, if the whole this trend carries on like this way, because of course a lot of these houses, as we just talked about before earlier, these remodeling processes are just so invasive, and it really weakens the structure. And effectively, after being used for a number of years, it's just like the buildings just wouldn't stand the test of time. And these are already old structures. Because of all these invasive things that they do with it, it's just it's not going to last. And after that, they will just raise it to the ground and build another new buildings. In fact, it's actually happening right in the middle of Iksandong right now. But again, there's both the hipster cafe owners, or the city government, or anyone, or even the landlords who actually would rent these houses to them, hipster cafe owners, they just don't have any mindset for the long-term preservations at all. Nobody does. Yeah, because of that, I think it's so difficult to talk anything about what lies in the future of these houses.
Okay, that's brutal. But thanks a lot for kind of illuminating that situation for us. Well, and I want to move on now to a sort of topically adjacent issue of cultural heritage, and this is the topic of the temporary opening of Sungnangwan, a small private garden in a residential area in Sungbukdong, which is a neighborhood in the north part of Seoul, last April. And the opening of this little garden created a total media frenzy. The Cultural Heritage Administration designated it a scenic site, and the publicity launch was dense with language like "disclosed to the public after 200 years and one of Korea's three greatest traditional gardens." It was in another recent conversation that you had with the Korea Times where you kind of debunked the hype. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, debunking is the right word in that thing, I think. So I already knew about the true history of this particular garden, this particular estate, back as early as 2006, believe it or not. But I didn't actually bother to talk about this at all for anyone, largely because this was completely disclosed, completely closed off for the public, and it was a private property nobody could actually go into. But now when I saw all these big media frenzy going through all that, going about this particular estate, my conscience told me to do something about it. So basically what I showed them was that all of the buildings that they have in this estate, and the garden, first of all, much of the garden, structures of the garden is not old. What I say is that the whole estate, as we see it, the Sungnangwan estate, as we know it, it did not exist in this form until 1961. In the old days, in the late Joseon period, there were some prominent people who actually had their estate and probably a garden or so, maybe some summer homes, and maybe in this area, in the site, but none of these things exist. And all the structures and the garden and everything is a modern creation. They have little to nothing to do with the actual historical figures who lived in this in this spot. And the whole point of creating this estate in 1961 was that they wanted to create a big tourist hotel, a modern tourist attraction, and a hotel intended for the all these American troops and the UN troops to stay and have fun. But that business scheme fell through. It never materialized. So what you're dealing with this state is effectively is a 1961 creation that had very little to do with actual history, on the spot.
Yeah, I'm happy your conscience piped up and sort of pushed you into doing the right thing in sort of casting some light on that issue too. Well, so after talking for 20 minutes here, it's not going to surprise listeners to hear that you've played the role of a history guide in walking tours in Seoul, both with the Royal Asiatic Society Korea branch, the RASKB, and also independently. So I understand that some years ago, you gave an architectural tour of the abandoned red light district, Chungnyangni 588. So what about the architecture was unique and interesting in what was just essentially like a a sprawling, you know, a couple city blocks of empty, you know, rooms.
So, yeah, I mean, when, you know, like, let me tell you something. So when I made my announcements to do this sort of like a tour, many people kind of like, you know, gave us look, you see, because this is not some place that you would necessarily have the sort of like an architectural, like, you know, cultural tour of any kind. It doesn't really come like right close to it. But before now, of course, if you go to the area, it's completely, raised down. Like, I mean, there's nothing left in there. There's this big redevelopment plans going on right now in the spot right now. But what I found that's so fascinating about this particular area was that it actually had a very distinctive, like three different layers, you might say, of different time periods, different manifestation of this area. You're starting with some of the older structures, mostly hanungs, that were probably intended to be built as, you know, like brothels, even this early, in the early 1930s. And so at the very bottom of this area, you have these number of hanungs that are clearly built for that purpose in the early 1930s. And later on the western side of the section, you have much more recent structures, maybe dating from about mid to late 1950s and 60s, when this area became, for the first time, became known as the Red Light District officially. Mm-hmm. And after that, the closest side to the modern railroad station, the Cheongyang East Station, they had more recent buildings that was clearly built in the 1970s and later. So you have three different layers or strata of, you know, different buildings and how things were developed and how life was like. You can tell a lot of things about it besides, of course, what was going on, that is, you know, known to the public about all these, prostitution and all these, you know, things going on at this time. So, yeah, that was quite interesting, of course, but that's not the only, tours I gave. I gave lots of other tours, palaces, historic sites, and all these different small scale. And I'm happy to say that I had a fairly large turnout for most of these events, and I'm really grateful that many people did actually show up to my tours, and showed quite a lot of interest on that.
Sure, and I've heard that they're extremely fascinating, and so I'm curious, of any tours that you've done independently, including the Cheongyang Ni 588 tour, or any tours you've done with the RASKB that are maybe more traditional, dealing with sort of historical neighborhoods or architecture, over the last couple of years, which one's been like your favorite? Which one do you actually like enjoy giving the most?
So I gave a tour. I gave this tour for the for RASKB. I think a couple of years ago, 2016, I believe, and it was about these. It was about this place, and it was basically northwest side of the Seoul, where not many people actually had an eyes on. Starting from the Changi-mun or Jaha-mun, as they call it, and going through different parts of the this area where it's literally filled with so many different historic sites, but most of which are not known to the public, even to the Korean people. So yeah, it was quite fascinating. And in fact, me and a friend of mine actually wrote a little book called Through the Gates of Violet Glow. And you can actually purchase it from Amazon, but so that's a little bit of a promotion here.
Well, that's really interesting, and it just makes me. It kind of reminds me that what I love about walking tours, like historical walking tours from someone who's really well versed, is it's like there's a magic to it, right? Just like revealing hidden secrets, revealing ghosts of the past. And so I just love that the RASKB does this, and I really appreciate that you're quite successful in really communicating with the guests who join you on these tours. And so, Jihoon, as we begin to wrap up, I wanted to talk for a minute about your focus of academic research at the University of Michigan, because it concerns the study of cultural history of modern Korea, which is post-1876, and the role of modern, that's non-textual media like sound recordings and films and broadcasting in the creation of this notion of Korean national and traditional culture in the first half of the 20th century. So how did you get interested in this kind of fascinating but usually or often overlooked aspect of Korean history?
I always loved music and, you know, like watching films and all that. And I also dabbled in all kinds of other like hobbies. And I also collect records, I collect films. And when I say collect films, I'm not saying I collect DVDs or anything, Blu-rays. I'm collecting films on like 8mm films. I also realized over the course of my pursuit of like doing history. I mean, Korean history to pursue. I mean, I do all kinds of history, but I like Korean history is my thing. And, you know, history was always my passion, a big, like, you know, like goal in my life doing this, like studying this. Like I have been doing this since I was 7. Like over the course of time, you begin to realize that, you know, all the things that you just take for granted, like all these traditional things, like for instance, so imagine someone from like pre-modern Korea. And the first thing you come to your mind is a person wearing a kat, the horse, like a horsehair hat. And the turumagi, the white, like this kind of like a robe that, you know, everybody wore. That's the thing. Everybody did not actually like wore these two things. Like there were so many different variants of hats and, you know, like robes and clothing that was so much like just all over the place. Like throughout much of the Joseon Dynasty. In fact, if you read Isabella Bird Bishop in her book Korea and Her Neighbor, she actually calls the country. She also refers the country as the hat country because there are so many different types of hats. But whatever became of these hats, right? I started to have this, you know, like this particular question in my head, and it just kind of struck me that, especially in the early 20th century. Of course, there were lots of scholars and, you know, academics and, you know, like writers who wrote about, you know, Korean culture and, you know, its characteristics. But the easier way for them to propagate the ideas about, you know, how a Korean tradition should be or should look like or should, you know, like, you know, sound like, these things were propagated through through these means of, you know, non-textual media, like, as I said, sound recordings and films, like radio broadcasts and all kinds of different things. And surely I realized, like slowly I realized that a lot of times, a lot of these people who were involved in these production of these materials, sound recordings, films, radio broadcasts, TV broadcasts, there are literally just a handful of same people, literally. These group of small like people, mostly educated in Japan or like or elsewhere, I mean foreign countries, and most of them dabbled in like theatrical businesses or all these different things. They also have like, you know, newspaper background as well. So like you have this group of individuals who had use their like knowledge and insights to produce these media. And to propagate their own vision and their own ideas about Korean culture. And of course, that eventually became the framework of how we understand the the past and the tradition and national culture, if you might say. So that's what I'm primarily doing.
It's so fascinating. But as we come to a close, I want to get to one last thing, which is that you actually traced the early history of recording music in the country to Western scholars in the early 1890s when Thomas Edison's phonograph came to Korea, and patrons of this phonograph included the likes of King Gojong and actually also RASKB founder Horace Allen. And you yourself actually have a machine for recording sound onto wax cylinders. Is that right? Tell me more about that.
So as you probably saw that there's a whole lecture video of me doing like a lecture about early sound recording histories, like in Korea, in like for the RASKV. And I do, yes, I do have a machine, a phonograph, an Edison standard phonograph that you can record, like wax cylinders. I mean, the good thing about one thing interesting about Edison cylinders at the time, it was not just meant for the playback. You could, by just swapping, one part, you can actually record on it, just like cassette tapes back in the day. And of course, you can actually, shave the cylinders and record more. So it's literally just like cassette tapes. But so I have demonstrated the process, and of course that's sort of a way of recording someone, like on site and just play it for the audience was probably the earliest earliest ways of Koreans using this new media format when it was first introduced in 1890s. And I said I also collect records and all that, and I have been working on like early sound recordings of Korean music or spoken words, and I also happen to find I like happen to have personally found some of these unique copies of these early very some of our earliest commercial recordings of musical recordings of Korean music. Made by the American, like Victor and Columbia companies. And I'm still on, I'm actually working on reissuing some of these things in the future on a CD. Much of the remastering job and everything, like I'm also a big audio guy, as you know. Yeah, I've been working on this, and much of the through the help of many others, we managed to finish remastering of some of these recordings, and hopefully we can get some funding for reissuing the CD in the future.
That's so cool. Come back on the show sometime and talk to me about this. Talk to me more about this sort of like modern archaeology that you uncover with your not just research, but also probably going to like dusty flea markets and the like. It's so interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
Oh, yeah.
And June, just last thing, where do you see the research that you're doing taking you in 2020 and over the next years?
Well, it's kind of difficult to tell, of course. I'm just beginning my second year as a PhD student here, so I still have literally 3 more years and almost 4 years exactly, because it hasn't started yet. Hopefully I can raise more awareness about how the notion of Korean culture and the way we understand Korean culture came to being. That might also benefit us overall to have more nuanced and more in-depth detailed understanding of how the notion of nationhood and national culture came to place. Everybody knows about, a lot of people knows about, Erik Hobsbawm and invented traditions and all these different things about the creation of nationhood and national culture traditions and things. But no one, so far as I can tell, hardly anyone specifically studied the Korean case in this regard. So I really hope that I can make some improvements over that.
Jun Suk is a PhD student in Asian languages and cultures at the University of Michigan and a keen observer of cultural heritage in Seoul and around the country. Jihoon, thanks a lot for speaking with the Koreophile.
Again, thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 86 of The Koreophile. Hear my other work on Canadian politics and society on the Unpacking the News podcast with Ricochet Media. Look for it on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Andre Margoulet. Music on this episode is courtesy of Creative Commons. The Koreophile is a monthly podcast exploring Korean society, culture, and politics, highlighting critical, independent voices you won't find anywhere else. And the show is produced and hosted on a volunteer basis. Contributing just a few dollars a month at patreon.com/thekoreophile helps to keep this show on the air. Your support covers hosting fees and the hours of production that go into creating a research-heavy show like this. Help us reach 20 monthly supporters, and I'll be able to begin releasing bonus material and outtakes from the interview. We have 6 supporters as of August 2019, so support from listeners like you guys is critical and allows this show to continue coming out consistently on a monthly basis. Become a monthly patron at patreon.com/thekoreophile. Find new episodes of The Koreaphile on iTunes, Spotify, and rate or review the show wherever you subscribe. It'll help new listeners discover the show. I'll be back in late September with the next in a series of collaborative episodes with the Seoul-based Korea branch of history and culture organization, the Royal Asiatic Society. Until then, I'm Andre Goulet. Thanks for listening.